Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Narayanam namaskritya. Naram chaiva narottamam. Devim Saraswatim Vyasam Tato Jayam Udirayet Nasta Prayeshwa Bhadreshu Nityam Bhagavata Sevaya Bhagavati Uttama Shloke Bhaktir Bhavati Naishtaki. Reading this morning from the Srimad Bhagavatam, first canto, and we'll be covering several chapters this morning. But before we do, let's turn to our verses for memorization. Everyone ready? Savai pumsam parodharmo yato bhaktir adhoksaje. Ahoitaki apratihata yayatma suprasidati. The supreme occupation, dharma, for all humanity is that by which men can attain to loving devotional service unto the transcendent Lord. Such devotional service must be unmotivated and uninterrupted to completely satisfy the self. Vasudeve Bhagavati Bhakti Yoga Prayojita Janayat yashuvairagyam yanam chayadahoitikam. By rendering devotional service unto the personality of Godhead, Sri Krishna, one can immediately acquire causeless knowledge and detachment from the world. Vipada santutak shashvat tatra tatra jagadgaro bhavato darshanam yatsyat apunar bhavadarshanam. I wish that all those calamities would happen again and again, so that we could see you again and again, for seeing you means that we will no longer see repeated births and deaths. Etan nirvidyamananam ichitam akuto bhayam yoginam nipanir nitam harinam anukirtanam. O King, constant chanting of the holy name of the Lord after the ways of the great authorities is a doubtless and fearless way of success for all, including those who are free from all material desires, those who are desirous of all material enjoyment, and also those who are self-satisfied by dint of transcendental knowledge. Very good. So before we begin reading this morning, I'd like to do a little bit of review for the benefit of those who are new to this cast of personalities. Yesterday we had the good fortune of hearing from Narayani Prabhu about the prayers of whom? Queen Kunti, right. By the way, she had just finished, by Krishna's arrangement, you know, this one day she was free to give our class. She had just finished doing a seminar on the prayers of Queen Kunti in Alachua, a whole several multi-day seminar. So we were very fortunate to get the essence. So Kunti is the mother of whom? The Pandavas. And the widow of who? Pandu. Right. So Pandu died, leaving five sons, the eldest of whom was Yudhisthira. So everyone's clear on this. Yudhisthira. Who was another prominent brother among the Pandavas? Arjuna. All right. So their grandfather, through a complicated series of arrangements, was whom? Bhishma. Correct. So Bhishma was fatally injured in the Battle of Kurukshetra. As we heard yesterday, when Yudhisthira, after having won the throne, was not interested in ruling, or finding himself unable to muster the enthusiasm to do it. He went to whom for instructions? First he went to Krishna, yes. And even Krishna couldn't cheer him up. So then he went to Bhishma. So we read yesterday how Yudhisthira Krishna and many sages gathered there before the dying Bhishma and asked him questions. This is something you don't usually do to somebody who's on their deathbed. You know, you come and ask them, tell me, give me instructions. teach me something. You know, usually go and ask that person, what could I do to help you? I went to see Brahmatirtha Prabhu yesterday. Brahmatirtha just had some nasal surgery and for a long-standing sleep apnea condition. And he looks terrible. looks like somebody punched him in the face really hard. I wasn't going asking him, well, could you please do this for me and that for me? I was going to try to give him some encouragement, taking some of Sunanda's wonderful soup from yesterday's Krishna lunch. So we generally don't go to a person who's in pain and say, could you please help me with something? But Krishna and Yudhisthira and all the Pandavas did that. So this chapter 9 in the first canto deals with the teachings of Bhishma Day. Then we're going to read in summary chapter 10, which is the chapter in which Krishna finally gets to go to leave Hastinapur. Remember, he was trying before the prayers of Queen Kunti, and he was trying after the prayers of Queen Kunti. And then Yudhisthira wanted him to stay for several months. So finally, he's able to leave, and that's chapter 10. All the feelings of the residents of Hastinapur as Krishna is departing for Dwarka. And then chapter 11, which we'll also read in summary this morning, is Krishna's arrival in Dwarka and how he greets everyone and everyone greets him. Then chapter 12 is the birth of King Parikshit. This also we'll read in summary because it's not instrumental to the plot. It's the one chapter in the first canto where we find Yudhisthira happy. All the other chapters, he is the hero of this part of the first canto. He's the main personality. And every chapter he's distressed one way or the other, except chapter 12. His grandson is born, he's been saved by Krishna in the womb, and he's forecast to be this wonderful personality. So Yudhisthira is very happy. And then we'll enter into chapter 13, which is the beginning of the end of the reign of the Pandavas, the return of whom? Who's been out on pilgrimage during the battle? Vidura, yes, Vidura. So Vidura comes back to the palace of the Pandavas, and that will be the end of our reading this morning. Just when Vidura is about ready to speak to his brother, whose name is Dhritarashtra, right? So that will be for our next class. So if you would please, let us turn. The end of the teachings of Bhishma. Page 44. This is page 44. We'll just read these last few descriptions of the passing away of Bhishma Day. Starting with text 49. Right? Then Bhishma fully turned his gaze and thoughts to Krishna's face and stopped his speech and breathing at his chosen time and place. Beholding Bhishma's passing, which was peaceful and sublime, his audience grew silent as the birds in evening time. Then men and gods struck kettle drums in praise of Bhishma's grace, and streams of flower petals from the sky adorned his face. Although he knew that Bhishma reached his goal of pure devotion, King Yudhisthira was briefly overtaken by emotion. The sages sang in praise of Krishna from the Vedic hymns, then left the battlefield for home, immersed in thoughts of him. In bitter triumph, Pandu's sons approached Hastinapur to comfort those who lost their loved ones in the dreadful war. Thereafter, Yudhisthira, the king of great religious fame, prepared himself to govern, just as Bhishma had explained. The aged Dhritarashtra helped his nephew take the throne, and Krishna also came to help before his journey home. Please note that Dhritarashtra has lost all 100 of his sons, right? Or 99 of them, right? 101. Oh, 101. Okay, so 100. He had one surviving son who joined the other side. But Dhritarashtra has nonetheless brought himself to help Yudhisthira, although it was quite painful for him. So, chapter 6 in this book, Krishna leaves Hastinapur. And how, you ask, did Yudhisthira give up or set aside the guilt he had been feeling since so many men had died? Both Bhishma and Lord Krishna helped relieve his great remorse, so he and his four brothers put the kingdom back on course. The wise and pious Yudhisthira spread such a godly mood that ample rains began to fall and earth produced more food. So happy were the cows protected by his righteous shield that milk from their abundant udders soaked the grazing fields. The rivers quenched the farmers' lands and oceans yielded jewels. The forests offered fruits and herbs and wood to use for fuel. Because they loved King Yudhisthira, who had no one to fear, the citizens felt fit and calm. Their troubles disappeared. Once Krishna had helped Yudhisthira and eased those hearts aggrieved by losses in the battle, he declared it time to leave. He took permission from the king, bowed low before the throne, and climbed aboard his chariot for Dwarka, his home. Since sages grow attached to Krishna, hearing these narrations, how could those who saw him daily ever stand his separation? While Krishna was preparing to depart that very day, the royalty who saw him nearly fainted dead away. Observing Krishna closely with unblinking, anxious stares, the palace residents were stunned and wondered here and there. A flock of ladies dashed to see him, sad and thunderstruck, attempting to hold back their tears for fear of evil luck. With shyness and with admiration, from the palace roof, the ladies tossed down flowers, keeping physically aloof. The sounds of conch shells, drums, and flutes, and strings, and bells, and more, all loudly honored Krishna as he left Hastinapur. Absorbed in thoughts of Krishna, all the ordinary men exalted him in poetry as sweet as Vedic hymns. While climbing to their rooftops to extend their fond farewells, the ladies of Hastinapur spoke thus among themselves. Oh, there goes Krishna, God himself, the shelter of us all. He makes this world of matter for we spirit souls who fall, but great devotees, free of sin and all mundane desire, can go again to Krishna as their mortal lives expire. The Vedas praise Lord Krishna and his great activities. He spins out giant planets and withdraws them all with ease. When beastly men disguised as kings take charge, the Lord descends to vanquish them in different ways while rescuing his friends. How blessed is Mathura! Krishna plays there as a boy. How blessed are the Yadus, for he brings their kingdom's joy. And Dwarka, his capital, makes heaven appear vile, for all of its inhabitants can see his pleasing smile. Lord Krishna's queens in Dwarka, though sought by lesser men, fulfilled their deepest heart's desire when they were wed to him. Just how were they so privileged to gain his loving kiss? The very thought makes Vraja's gopis faint away in bliss. On hearing these enchanting words, Lord Krishna glanced and smiled, and then left Hastinapur for his queens and domicile. Though Yudhisthira and others walked with him for quite a way, at last the Lord convinced them they were duty-bound to stay. So that was chapter 10, now chapter 11. Krishna reaches Dwarka. Lord Krishna entered Dwarka and blew his conch aloud. The residents rejoiced as if the sound had lifted clouds. The white, enormous conch shell, tinged with red where Krishna blew, resembled a white swan at play in crimson lotus blooms. The sound of Krishna's conch shell made the people so inspired they ran to have his audience, at which they had long desired. As they gave gifts to Krishna, Lord Supreme of everyone, they seem like priests who offer tiny candles to the sun. And here's the case again where all the citizens, through telepathy, speak the same thing at the same time. The people said, "Our dear Lord Krishna, gods declare your praise. Your very form is endless truth that time cannot decay. O mother, or father, mother, guru, God, by following your trail we all feel blessed and meet success in every detail. The moments turn to centuries whenever you're away. You leave us all in darkest night without the hope of day. Now, once again, your charming smile has quieted our fear. The gods in heaven envy us for having you so near. O Krishna, when you go away and we don't see your smile, who else can ease our suffering and make our lives worthwhile? On seeing Krishna glance at them and feeling reassured, the people spoke of Krishna with incessant pleasing words. The city, kissed by shining sun and gentle springtime showers, displayed her gardens, orchards, parks, and lakes with lotus flowers. Fresh mango and banana leaves adorned the promenade, where garlands, flags, and painted banners all provided shade. The people cleansed the lanes and grounds with water and perfume, and everywhere were fruits and grains and flowers freshly bloomed. To welcome back Lord Krishna, each and every house displayed fresh yogurt, water, fruits, and incense set on silver trays. On learning of the Lord's return, the royal family rose up from rest or dining and departed hurriedly. With elephants and bugle blasts, they rode on royal carts, and as the priests recited hymns, affection filled their hearts. The actors, singers, artists, and the scribes of history all celebrated Krishna, each by their ability. And even well-known prostitutes, the victims of ill chance, came out to see the Lord arrive, their beauty much enhanced. Lord Krishna offered due respect to everyone who came and greeted both the common folk and those of royal fame. He bowed his head, shook hands, embraced, and gave out words of thanks to bless and reassure them all, regardless of their ranks. The senior priests and relatives praised Krishna loud and long, and everyone exalted him with thunderous, blissful song. Observing from their palace roofs, the ladies were amazed as Krishna turned the morning to a festive holiday. The citizens of Dwarka saw Krishna frequently, and yet they never missed a single opportunity. His lotus feet are havens, and his face the source of charm. Queen Lakshmi lives upon his chest, the gods within his arms. Lord Krishna's face, the color of the clouds of the monsoon, was shaded by umbrellas shaped like flaxen autumn moons. It shone upon his garlands, strung in gorgeous rainbow stripes, upon his yellow silken dress that flashed like lightning strikes. On entering his father's house, the Lord was pleased to see his father's many wives and his own mother, Devaki. The ladies all embraced their son as milk enlarged their breasts, and when he sat upon their laps, their tears came forth unchecked. Thereafter, Krishna left for his palatial private homes. In each one lived a wife convinced the Lord was hers alone. By wondrous mystic power, Krishna managed to expand for 16,000 palaces, held queens who took his hand. His queens came running forth to him, rejoicing in their minds, for he had been away from them for quite a lengthy time. Within their hearts they held him, though in public they were shy, and as they sent their sons to greet him, tears adorned their eyes. Lord Krishna stayed close by his wives, as any husband should, and they did not grow tired of him, as common spouses would. For even Lakshmi, queen of wealth, whose restlessness is famed, will always stay at Krishna's feet. Could any woman stray? Lord Krishna felt at peace after the Kurukshetra war, for armies that had burdened earth could trouble her no more. As one rubs bamboo branches to ignite a forest fire, the Lord created enmity and filled the earth's desire. What was the earth's desire? To? Yes, all this unnecessary armies. That's the beginning of Krishna's pastimes, first thing in the Krishna book. The earth was feeling overburdened by this weight of all these unnecessary armies. So Krishna relieved them. Okay, hang on just a minute. At last, at home at last among his wives, he seemed a common man, though Krishna always comes and acts as only Krishna can. A single queen could turn Lord Shiva's rock-hard vows to dust, yet all his queens together could not conjure Krishna's lust. A worldly soul imagines that the Lord is just like him and suffers from attachments and desires he cannot stem. Though Krishna does encounter matter, he remains divine, and so do those who follow him with loving, steadfast minds. Lord Krishna's wives, divinely tricked, could only think of him as their beloved husband, not the goal of Vedic hymns. Like atheists who can't see God, these rare devoted souls could not imagine God could be a person they controlled. Okay. Your questions, go ahead.
Yeah, first question is, when Krishna was on earth, So what was the mood like? Is it the same as the spiritual world here?
No, only a handful of people knew that Krishna was God. Mm-hmm. So it's different.
And the next question is, so Krishna could have sent anyone for lowering the burden, but he came himself, so...
Krishna could have sent anyone for lowering the burden, yet he came himself. So, why was that? Pardon? Yes, to please his devotees. This is his periodic appearance. It was time for that. So, that was the answer Lord Vishnu gave to the demigods when they came to ask help for earth. So, Lord Krishna is personally going to come. So, yes, it's not always that way, but it was on this occasion. Okay, chapter 7, the birth of Vishnurata. Vishnurata is whom?
Parikshit
Maharaj, yes. You now have heard how Krishna helped to settle Yudhisthira and then returned to Dwarka, where people held him dear. Let's now discuss the embryo within Uttara's womb, the heir to Pandu's kingdom and the grandson of Arjuna. Do you recall how Krishna saved the unborn little boy when Ashwatthama, son of Drona, angrily deployed the great Brahmastra weapon, which can devastate the earth? The unborn child saw Krishna's beauty well before his birth. Bound up inside Uttara's womb, the child felt brutal heat, a sign of the Brahmastra, which no mortal could defeat. And then he saw the Lord appear, no larger than a thumb. On seeing this enchanting sight, the child was overcome. With robes of yellow silk and golden helmet on his head, the Lord looked quite appealing, though his eyes were fury red. His club in hand, he vanquished the Brahmastra's deadly hue as easily as morning sunlight dries a drop of dew. Lord Krishna, God, is everywhere, unchecked by time or space. He always saves the righteous and puts sinners in their place. Diffusing the Brahmastra in the presence of the child, Lord Krishna disappeared and left the tiny boy beguiled. In time, the stars and planets shifted to auspicious signs and ushered to the world the heir of Pandu's royal line. The vigilant King Yudhisthira observed this with delight and bid the royal priests to execute the proper rites. In honor of the newborn boy, King Yudhisthira released much gold and land and other wealth to suit the royal priests. Content with Yudhisthira, his gifts, and all that had occurred, the priests extolled his heritage and grandson with these words. The timing of this person's birth has very clearly shown that God has sent a spotless child to grace King Pandu's throne. Lord Krishna saved him in the womb, so let the prince be known as Vishnurata, one whose life depends on God alone. Said Yudhisthira, O best of those who know astrology, will this child guard religion and yet rule effectively? Will he be as accomplished and as famous in his time as all his predecessors in King Pandu's royal line? The priest replied, When he is king, this child shall be acclaimed for guarding man and beast alike who live within his reign. Like mighty Ram, who left his throne to fill his father's vow, where this child rules, deceitfulness will never be allowed. In days gone by, the great King Shibi saved a helpless bird. An eagle had it cornered, but King Shibi gave his word to substitute his own flesh for the hungry eagle's beak. This child shall likewise grant complete protection for the weak. In shooting arrows he shall match Arjuna. He shall be compelling like a forest fire and forceful like the sea. With lion strength he'll answer any troubled person's call, just as the Himalayan range can shelter one and all. Forbearing as the earth, and fair in mind as you, O King, this child, like generous Shiva, will give people everything. The citizens shall flock to him for safety, hope, and wealth, as people flock to Krishna, even Lakshmi with her wealth. King Rantidev, a saintly soul, had fasted 40 days, then gave away his breakfast meal to guests who came his way. This child shall match King Rantidev in magnanimity and nearly equal Krishna in such godly qualities. In patience, he'll match Bali, who had seized the god's abode, then gave it all to Krishna, though his guru ordered no. In staunch determination, he will equal young Prahlad, whose father tried to kill him for advancing love of God. Protecting peace on earth, he will rebuke offensive men. His children will be glorious and saintly, just like him. Though knowing of his death well in advance, he won't protest. Instead, he'll turn to Krishna and renounce his royal dress. The learned Sukadev shall guide him through this fatal strife and help him find Lord Krishna and fulfill his goal in life. King, that's a very odd prediction, you notice, at the end, that he'll know his about his death in advance. Generally, astrologers will not tell you the time of death. That is the sign of an ethical astrologer. They can see in your chart when it looks like you're going to die, but they won't tell you. Unless they really don't like you. King Yudhisthira heard all of this, and feeling very pleased, he blessed the court astrologers with all necessities. He pictured Vishnurata growing like the waxing moon and seeking out Lord Krishna, whom he'd seen while in the womb. To celebrate the prince's birth and clear away the sin of Kurukshetra's battle, which destroyed so many men, King Yudhisthira performed a costly Vedic sacrifice as Bhishma and Lord Krishna had repeatedly advised. So this is the happy chapter coming to an end. Now, Dhritarashtra leaves home. I'll read the first few texts, and our verse today is number 13 from this chapter. Now let us all go back in time before... This is a little background that's added for the sake of those who are new to the Mahabharata. So let us now go back in time before the fateful war when Pandu ruled the kingdom and was generally adored. His older brother, Dhritarashtra, would have had his place, but he was blind at birth and thus unfit to lead his race. A third brother, Vidura, who was youngest of the three, could not become the king because his mother wasn't queen. The sons of Dhritarashtra snatched the throne when Pandu died, but Pandu's sons recovered it with Krishna at their side. Ignoring family battles, wise Vidura kept his head and left the lavish palace for a king, pilgrim's humble bed. In classic Vedic fashion, he attended holy sites, awakening devotion with his spiritual delight. The civil war completed and the Pandavas enthroned, Vidura, in his wisdom, finally made his way back home. Queen Kunti, Dhritarashtra, the five Pandavas, and all rejoiced to greet Vidura as he reached the palace hall. So you get the picture. Vidura had not taken part in the war. He just left. He was on pilgrimage the whole time. Now the war is over. Yudhisthira is ruling. Dhritarashtra is in the palace, and Vidura returns. The family members all agreed Vidura gave them strength, and they embraced him feelingly and praised him at some length. King Yudhisthira at once arranged Vidura's food and rest, then seated him with everyone and asked his honored guest, "Our dear Uncle Vidura, I recall your caring arms, protecting us from poison and a fire's deadly harm." This is when the Duryodhana and his brothers were trying to kill the Pandavas. Vidura would warn them. He would give them secret messages, and Yudhisthira could understand these messages and took the hint and escaped these attacks each time. "While traveling, how did you cope and care for life and limb? What sites of God did you attend, and how did you serve him? A man like you can make a place seem sacred, pure, and bright. It seems by Krishna's grace you are a walking holy site. Now, did you go to Dwarka, where Krishna's family remains absorbed in thoughts of him in loving ecstasy?" Vidura then pleased everyone by telling of his tour and how he met Maitreya, whose instructions made him pure. He answered every question raised by Yudhisthira that day except of Dwarka and Krishna's family and their fate. Vidura couldn't bear to pain his nephew's smiling face, recounting the disasters that he knew had taken place. "They'll learn about it soon enough. The wise Vidura mused, "Why should I spoil their happiness, disclosing dreadful news?" What was it that Vidura knew that he wasn't telling Yudhisthira? That Krishna had left. Yes, and the Yadus had killed each other. So, Vidura, in those days, remember, they didn't have CNN. They didn't have email. You know? So, Vidura knew all this, and he wasn't telling Yudhisthira. So kind. You know, do you ever have some, like, bad news? You can't wait to tell everybody. So Vidura is very gracious like this. Although he had renounced the world and had no needs at all, Vidura stayed there with his kin within the palace walls. His nephews asked for guidance, and he answered them in kind, though it was Dhritarashtra that Vidura had in mind. Vidura knew his other work did not demand his time. He knew the reign of Yudhisthira would surely be sublime. He also knew how time creeps up and wholly overwhelms a soul engrossed in family life who thinks of nothing else. So that is our verse for today. And tomorrow we'll begin, or on Friday we'll read the instructions of Vidura to Dhritarashtra. Okay, this is text 17 from the 13th chapter. Yes. Evam griheshu shaktanam. Please chant. Let's do this responsibly, sure. Evam griheshu. Okay, let's try one more time. Responsibly, please. Evam griheshu shaktanam. Pramatanam tadihaya. Atyakramad eva evi avigyatam. Kalak paramadushtaraham. Evam griheshu saktanam. Pramatanam tadihaya. Atyakramad evi avigyatam. Avigyata kalak paramadushtaraha. Dushtaraha. Please chant. Go ahead, bro.
Evam griheshu
saktanam. Evam griheshu saktanam.
Pramatanam
tadihaya. Ajakramad avigyata kalak paramadushtaraha. Evam griheshu saktanam pramatanam adihaya. Adyakramad avigyata alak paramadushtaraha. Evam greshu sakanam ramatanam tadihaya. Adyakramad avigyata kala paramadushtaraha. Thank you. Please scroll down. Synonym. Okay. Evam. Thus. Griheshu. In the family affairs. Saktanam. Of persons who are too attached. Pramatanam, insanely attached. Tat ihaya, engrossed in such thoughts. Atyakramat, surpassed. Avigyataham, imperceptibly. Kalaham, eternal time. Parama, supremely. Dustaraha, insurmountable. Srila Prabhupada's translation and purport. Insurmountable eternal time imperceptibly overcomes those who are too much attached to family affairs and are always engrossed in their thought. Purport, who's got the mic, please? Please start. Ollie, would you like to start?
I am now happy. I have everything in order. My bank balance is quite enough. I can now give my children enough estate. I am now successful. The poor beggar sannyasis depend on God, but they come to beg from me. Therefore, I am more than the supreme God. These are some of the thoughts which engross the insanely attached householder who is blind to the passing of eternal time. Our duration of life is measured, and no one is able to enhance it even by a second against the scheduled time ordained by the supreme will. Such valuable time, especially for the human being, should be cautiously spent, because even a second passed away imperceptibly cannot be replaced, even in exchange for thousands of golden coins amassed by hard labor. Every second of human life is meant for making an ultimate solution to the problems of life, i.e., repetition of birth and death, and revolving in the cycle of 8,400,000 different species of life. The material body, which is subject to birth and death, diseases, and old age, is the cause of all sufferings of the living being. Otherwise, the living being is eternal. He is never born, nor does he ever die.
Foolish person forget this problem. They do not know at all how to solve the problems of life, but become engrossed in temporary family affairs, not knowing that eternal life is passing away imperceptibly and that their measured duration of life is diminishing every second. Without any solution to the big problem, namely repetition of birth and death, disease and old age, this is called illusion.
But such illusion cannot work on one who is awake in the devotional service of the Lord. Yudhisthira Maharaj and his brothers, the Pandavas, were all engaged in the service of Lord Sri Krishna, and they had very little attraction for the illusory happiness of this material world. As we have discussed previously, Maharaj Yudhisthira was fixed in the service of the Lord Mukunda, the Lord who can award salvation, and therefore he had no attraction even for such comforts of life as are available in the kingdom of heaven, because even the happiness obtained on the planet Brahmaloka is also temporary and illusory.
Because the living being is eternal, he can be happy only in the eternal abode of the kingdom of God, Parabrahma, from which no one returns to this region of repeated birth and death, disease and old age. Therefore, any comfort of life or any material happiness which does not warrant an eternal life is but illusion for the eternal living being.
One who understands this factually is learned, and such a learned person can sacrifice any amount of material happiness to achieve the desired goal known as Brahma Shakyam. I have such bad eyesight. Absolute happiness. Real transcendentalists are hungry for the happiness, and as a hungry man cannot be made happy by all comforts of life,
never.
Minus foodstuffs, so the man hungry for eternal absolute happiness cannot be satisfied by any amount of material happiness. Therefore, the instructions described in the verse can be applied, cannot be applied to Maharaj Yudhisthira or his brothers and mother. It was meant for persons like Dhritarashtra, for whom Vidura came especially to impart lessons.
Okay, just before you switch, let's go back to the end of the purport. I just want to call attention to those last two sentences. Therefore, the instruction described in this verse cannot be applied to Maharaj Yudhisthira or his brothers and mother. It was meant for persons like Dhritarashtra, for whom Vidura came especially to impart lessons. And translation again, please. So this is a very important point, especially for those who are new to Krishna consciousness. Please listen carefully and try to assimilate what I'm going to say. Insurmountable eternal time imperceptibly overcomes those who are too much attached to family affairs and are always engrossed in their thought. Here's this is just a warm-up spoken by Suta Goswami before Vidura pulls out the heavy artillery for Yudhisthira. This is just like an appetizer to the verses that are coming next. And then again, in the second chapter, the whole first canto is all the lead up to about Parikshit and about his history. So in the beginning of second canto, then Sukadev starts speaking for the first time. And the first things out of his mouth are some of the heaviest verses in the whole Srimad Bhagavatam. Griheshu, griha medinam. You know, they have enough experience. People have experience, and still they spend their lives all night having sex and sleeping, and all day making money for sense gratification. He just comes out blasting like this, you know. And this purport references Rishabhdev's teachings in the fifth canto. I think the word is used there, pramata. Pramata kurukte vikarma. That pramata means not just, bipolar. It means like, extremely insane, right? Mutta. So pramata. Very crazy. And Rishabhdev describes people who are absorbed in family life as being very crazy. Very, very crazy. So this is a repeated theme in Srimad Bhagavatam. Now, people who have only a superficial understanding of this subject will think, okay, family bad, renunciation good. Okay, and this is one kind of mistake. Another kind of mistake, though, is thinking, okay, I've got renunciation, I've got Krishna consciousness, now let me just go enjoy family life to my heart's content. Now, that's another kind of illusion. See, so what we're trying to find here is a kind of middle path where people understand that it is possible to live a renounced Krishna conscious family life, but it is not automatic. It's not just an easy thing because you've got the name and the beads and the tilak, you know. So how to make our lives a balance where we appreciate people in any order or ashram based on their devotional qualities and renunciation. Radhanath Maharaj likes to tell about when he first went to the Chaupati temple. And there were very few devotees there. And there were a few brahmacharis living in the temple. And they were completely at odds with the householders who lived outside the temple. Big friction, big tension. You know, the householders thought these brahmacharis are lazy and they just sit around all day. And the brahmacharis thought these householders are so attached they just sit at home and stare in each other's eyes all day. And because of this friction, the temple was not doing that well. So one of the first things he did is to create an appreciation for the brahmacharis amongst the householders and the householders amongst the brahmacharis. See, it is very difficult to appreciate another person's situation. This is actually what it means to be to have compassion, to be able to see life from another person's perspective and not judge them. In the course of our lives, when people do us wrong, which inevitably happens to us all, whether it's a parent or a sibling or a neighbor or a stranger or a former friend or a former spouse, we will feel animosity that will burden us. See, that will just burden us until we come to the point of forgiveness. The forgiveness is not for the sake of the person we're forgiving. It's for our sake. Right? But until we can see things from that person's point of view, it is impossible to forgive them. We're thinking that if we just criticize them long enough and blame them and condemn them long enough, that eventually they're just going to grovel at our feet, and then we may be able to forgive them. Well, you know, in most cases, it ain't going to happen that way. You know? But we keep trying nonetheless. And this is why we suffer in the material world, because we cannot forgive. And we carry the burden of hatred. And then we can't appreciate who we really are. You know, this is a function of the bodily concept of life. Oh, this person has hurt me. We're going to talk about this in more detail. I think Nanda Kumar Prabhu is going to have that class next week. A beautiful section on the pastimes of Parikshit Maharaj in the bull. Right? But this is just a little preliminary because it's relevant to this thought. We cannot appreciate people in other situations in life unless we're a little advanced in Krishna consciousness. This is my point. So we'll talk about the big forgiveness next week. But the little appreciation for others has to do with this issue of ashram. You know, which ashram you are in, how you're living your life in Krishna consciousness. It is a real symptom of neophyte devotees to condemn people in other ashrams wholesale. You know, it is just a foolishness and an immaturity. Hridayananda Maharaj likes to joke about this subject. He says, before you criticize someone, you should walk a mile in their shoes, because then you'll be a mile away and you'll have their shoes and you can say whatever you want. So that's not what I'm talking about this morning. If we are not married, then we should understand that it is very difficult, but it is possible for people to be Krishna conscious in family life. This kind of verse, condemning family life, which we find repeatedly in Bhagavatam, as I mentioned, does not apply to Vaishnavas. Just as at the end of the purport, Prabhupada mentions, it does not apply to Yudhisthira, it applies to Dhritarashtra. See? So, if we are taking an attitude that those who are married are automatically fallen, you know, the deep dark well, all of the quotes, then we're actually committing a Vaishnava aparan. This is not at all healthy for our own spiritual life. On the other hand, if we are married and we're thinking that, oh, those who are not married have it so easy or are so puffed up or whatever, finding fault like that, that also is not good for our spiritual life. Our whole movement is based on jnana and vairagya, knowledge and renunciation. And that can be practiced in any stage, and it is not guaranteed by any external circumstance. It's an internal commitment to serve Krishna as a higher priority than this time-bound material world that's being described in the verse. Okay? So, if we think that our family, that our husband-wife relationship, that our money is going to save us, we're going to be sorely disappointed. These things are duties, that's all. They're things that will keep us engaged in the material world while we're advancing in spiritual life, if we do them religiously. But if we think that this is my shelter, I will get my family together, and then I'll get into Krishna consciousness, it is just like a dog chasing the tail. There's no end to it. It goes on and on and on, right? It is just a life of frustration. So we can always keep Krishna at the center. Doesn't mean we don't work hard. It doesn't mean that we don't earn money, that we don't take care of families. None of that. Keeping Krishna at the center is just the first relationship. Then so many other relationships can come after that. See? That is the advantage of being single, that it's easier to say, okay, Krishna is my first relationship. See? It's harder to keep that perspective, admittedly, when you have spouse and kids and so forth. But we have to see that my service to Krishna is in relation to my family. Just taking care of my family is my first responsibility for Krishna. See, that is a way to keep a balance in that juggling act. So whatever ashram we're in, all of these things we just read in the purport apply equally. That not one moment of our lives that we waste in something else can be purchased back for thousands of gold coins. Therefore, our time is our most precious asset. Right? And yet we go through life just squandering it. Oh, I have plenty of time. You see, this is what gets us in trouble. Prabhupada said that a pauper is proud of their penny. So even if we don't have much, we're very proud of it. See? So we feel, especially when we're young, we feel, I've got so much time. Okay, I may not have done this, I may not have done that, but I have so much time. So this is a big mistake. The time that you have when you are young is more precious than the time you have when you're old, actually. Dita and I attended a Christian offered financial peace university program, which I highly recommend to anyone who's going to be in Grihastha ashram. And one of the things they showed us is that a young person who saves money at age 20 or 25, saves a small amount of money, ends up with the same amount of money at age 65 as somebody who's been saving furiously starting at age 50. So just a little bit of money set aside at 25 turns into a huge amount by 65. So think in terms of spiritual life like that. If you invest now in your spiritual life as a young person, and this means like learning verses, learning how to associate properly with devotees in every ashram, learning how to do the Hari Bowls and the Kirtans and play the drums and play the kartals and cook the offerings and make the offerings and clean the bathrooms and all the things that devotees do. Just doing that now when you're young is such a great investment of time because that stays with you your whole life. Those verses are like old friends. You quote them when you're 60. Learn them when you're 20, quote them when you're 60. And in fact, Chanaka has a statement like this, right? That for a person who is traveling, knowledge is their one friend. So, investing our time very wisely at this stage is a way to deal with the fact that every day your physical body is deteriorating one more day. So, protecting yourself by Krishna consciousness is an activity that anyone can do in any ashram. If we're smart, we will be sure not to spoil our devotion by being critical of those in other ashrams, but appreciating all the Vaishnavas, everybody. And that protects us and prevents us from falling down. What does it mean to fall down? It's not that Krishna starts looking bad. It's just all the other stuff starts looking good. That's what happens when devotees fall down. And that's a result of committing offenses. That all of a sudden, Maya just starts looking really nice. Yeah, I've got my Krishna consciousness. Now I think I'll go do this for a while. I've got my Krishna consciousness. That's in my pocket. You know, that's, I got that down, man. Now this looks kind of interesting. See, that's where we get caught. Thank you. Any comments or questions? Yes, can we pass the mic for the recording? Chaitanya Dasi Prabhu. Yes. Thank you.
I was just thinking when you were talking about householder life and you were talking about the householder that's envious and that's engaging in sex life and sense gratification and not caring for their eternal goal, which is devotional life, and it's described as being a grihamedi, mm-hmm. versus the householder that's engaging in devotional service. And if they are engaged in sex life, it's once a month to procreate a Krishna conscious child. So as Vaishnavas, though, should we see each other as like not so much importance of the ashram as like isn't Vaishnava above
yes.
the different varna and ashrams?
Yes, Vaishnava is above the different varnas and ashrams. That's exactly right. The varnas and ashrams are meant for people who have not yet come to the Vaishnava stage. And at the same time, Vaishnavas use them and engage in them and accept them for the sake of teaching others. So that's Daivi Varnashram, when devotees are practicing Varnashram Dharma. But our goal is Krishna. And that's the conclusion of the Varnashram system. If somebody is fortunate, they come to the point of understanding. Varnashravam vibhagasaha swanushtitasya dharmasya sang sidhir haritoshanam. That the goal of life is pleasing Krishna. No, not us. See, that's different. Somebody who's chanting Hare Krishna seriously every day has already come to the point that's past Varnashram. That's my point. That's my whole point. That's already the Vaishnava platform. Even if we're not so experienced, even if we're not so advanced, we've come to the point of understanding that the goal of life is pleasing Krishna. And that we can do that in any varna or ashram or situation, right? So, the ashrams that we're in, the occupation that we're doing are all secondary considerations. If we remember this, that my goal here is pleasing Krishna. Okay? Okay? Andres Prabhu. Microphone, please.
Spending some time with Advaita Swami. His opinion of Alatra devotees is that they take Grihastha, but they think that's the final ashram, like that they're supposed to just die in Grihastha. But his point is that they're supposed to take Vanapras and then sannyas. So I just wanted to know your opinion of that subject.
Well, let's talk to Jita about that subject. Could we get the mic there, please? By Bob's grace, this is all being recorded. So,
I was having a conversation with a devotee in North Carolina about this because her husband had turned 50 and he immediately got in this frame of mind that, we have to, get ready to separate. And she was in a lot of anxiety. And they actually talked to Jayadvaita Maharaj about it. And she got to express her concerns that, she said her husband was a good moneymaker, so there's no financial worries for her. But there were so many other worries, so many other concerns, emotional needs and just, anyway, so we were talking that if they really want the men in ISKCON to renounce at the end of their life, they better start making facility for the women because there isn't really anything. And, the most we have is we see like a Lakshmimoni and a Kuti, and they struggle very, very hard to be single women in ISKCON. So that was her point, that she was open to the idea, but she wanted to make sure she'd be happy and fulfilled in Krishna conscious activities the rest of her life. And without that, it's just like a real insecurity for women to think of their husband leaving, and then what happens to me?
Yes, this is a good example of seeing both sides of the issue. Very easy. All the men should take sannyas, but then what will happen to the rest of the devotees? In fact, it's not essential. You cannot really validate that in the Shastra, that every man must take sannyas. It's recommended, but then Lord Chaitanya said it's not recommended for this age. Right? And we see, Krishna did not take sannyas. Right? There are many, many considerations in that topic. So that's where we get in trouble. We try to make everything fit, one size fits all. That's kind of impersonalism. right? And one size fits everybody. So that's the beautiful thing about our system. We have personalism and personal spiritual counsel, because the knowledge is there, but the application is individual. The knowledge is universal, but the application is very individual. Therefore, we have spiritual masters. See? And every educated person, cultured person, needs a spiritual master to help them apply the knowledge in their particular situation. So, Mike? Do you have the mic?
I always found the Vedic system very appealing because if your wife isn't so nice, it's just like, well, I just have to wait 25 years and then I can just take Vanaprast. And actually, most couples get, I think that's one of the reasons people get so many divorces these days, is because they're not taking Vanaprast. Anyways. Mm. Yeah, it's her lack of Krishna consciousness.
go. Okay. Oh, wait. Sorry, they can go together. Go, Paul Prabhu.
Isn't there a famous statement by Bhaktivinoda that if your house is Krishna conscious, there's no need to leave it?
Yes. Ye dina grihe bhajana deke grihe te goloka bhai. One day, in my house, I was performing my devotional activities when I saw my whole griha transform into Goloka Vrindavan. Bhaktivinoda Thakur says that. Yes, there are many. Many things. Prabhupada said, you do not need a pole to preach. the relationships are so much more important than these external, such as ashram or varna. And neophyte devotees think that the varna is everything, but advanced devotees understand, no, that devotion is everything. And the ashram is just a matter of convenience. Okay. What else? Sagar Prabhu. Oh, how about Bhai Bob? He's right there. Go ahead. Okay. Go ahead then, Sagar Prabhu.
I was wondering, if one is in grihastha and maybe he has attachments, like, still he has desires and attachments towards, because, you might have. So what, then vanaprastha, might be beneficial in that sense.
Yeah.
So again, is it personal? Can we have a general, what did Prabhupada say? What was Prabhupada's take on this? What are the statements?
See, the point is that if you enter family, if you can avoid family life altogether and do it comfortably, that's wonderful. And that's very good. If you cannot do that, then get married. And it's not a big deal. And then you get married and you have heavy responsibilities. I used to think I worked hard as a brahmachari. I work much harder as a grihastha. It's much more intense, And it's purifying in that way. It's very purifying. But you meet those responsibilities. But then when the children are grown, you're supposed to get more active in your spiritual life. So Prabhupada did say that was all appropriate and important for us to do as devotees. So if we're just a little practical about it, it's not very difficult to understand. Just being fanatic is religion without philosophy. So philosophy means we understand that relationships are the important things, that the value is really in the people and not in the clothes that they're wearing. Okay. That's philosophy. Pardon me? Yeah, the value is in the people and not in the clothes that they're wearing. You see? Actually, Bhai Bhav wanted to ask. Go ahead.
So if you're doing good in our family lives, when we see when we turn 50, then how do we decide whether we need to take Vanaprastha or not?
You see, it's not so much now I'm going to officially take Vanaprastha. It's just more we're going to get more into working in the mission. That's all.
So we can still be together and do service.
Yeah.
Because I read in the Veda Vyasa about this, when Prabhupada actually said that he said that sannyas is for Brahman, the Brahman has to take sannyas, but Kshatriyas, they can go only up to Vanaprastha. And Vaishyas, it is recommended they go up to grihastha life, they don't take Vanaprastha.
Mm-hmm.
And Shudra, Shudra has no. So yeah, I didn't. So like, I guess in devotees depends on our like our inclination or our like nature. We can be of Brahman nature, but depends like what are we doing for Krishna.
Yeah. Well, again, devotees are transcendental to all of these designations. That's what I'm trying to stress here. If a person understands that the goal of life is pleasing Krishna, they can work from any varna, any ashram, any situation. Yes. Yes, exactly. How we can best serve Krishna. And there's no set formula for every single person beyond 16 rounds and 4 regulative principles. Yes. Bye, Bob, and then Bart.
Well, Deepthi always has this doubt, and she says that she wants to make money to serve Krishna. So, what's the wrong part of this attitude?
That's
a leading question.
Yeah.
She wants to make money first and then want to serve Krishna.
I refuse to answer that question on the grounds that it may incriminate me. There's nothing wrong, and Prabhupada said, if our grihasthas can make money, let them do it full swing. You see? The problem with money is not money, it's how we use it, and how it affects us and puts us in maya. Oh, I like the beginning of this purport, now I've got lots of money, now I don't have to worry about anything. See? That's so stupid, because money doesn't really solve anything. Money just makes you more of what you already are. If you're, if you're a greedy, self-centered person, then having a lot of money will make you obnoxiously greedy and self-centered. And if you're a good-hearted person, having lots of money will make you more generous. You know, it doesn't change you; it just magnifies you, your nature. So, money is neither good nor bad. It's just something to be used in Krishna's service. Dharmasya hyapavargasya narta utayupakalpate. Nartasya dharmakantasya kamalabhayahi smritaha. A person on the path of spiritual life understands that money should be used for the service of Krishna and not for sense gratification. That's all.